It's time to talk some cricket, and to say it's been a big couple of weeks in cricket would be an absolute understatement. It's big enough leading up to an Ashes series, but all the dramas around Tim Payne. We've got a new captain. We're still looking for a new wicketkeeper, and we don't even know Perth's going to have a test this summer. Joining us on the line to talk about all the issues in cricket at the moment is Robert Craddock. G'day, Robert.
Hey, Julian. Yes, it's... it is a tumultuous time. We never know. I'm up here in Brisbane, you know, waiting for the first test on Wednesday week, and suddenly there's a real calmness about the place after hysteria of the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, a bit of calmness would be very nice at the moment. Before we get on to that first test at the Gabba and all the issues swirling around that, you've written about the Perth test today. The people of Perth almost scoffed at Tasmania for their bid to get the test. We know it's not going to go to Tassie if it's not in Perth. But what chances right now? We heard Christina Matthews on the weekend say it's probably only about 50-50 that Perth will have the Ashes test. Where do you see it sitting right now?
Yeah, I sometimes wonder whether Christina may have made that statement to try and get the government moving a bit, to try and make them just loosen their border protocols a little bit. Like, the one thing I do, if it stays how it is and there's no change, I'd say it's below 50%. It's probably more towards 2.5 out of 10, because the England players have just been categorical, Julian. They've said, we're not going into hard quarantine again after the initial period when we get here. We have to do a few days. But so you can imagine them after playing four tests in 5.5 weeks saying, right, now you're back in the hard quarantine in Perth. They're just not going to cop it.
No, and I don't think anyone's going to look down on the English for that, given everything they've been through, like most of our world cricketers in the last couple of years. Okay, so if it's not Perth, who's got their noses in front? Is it Sydney? Is it Melbourne?
Yeah, well, look, just to rule out a couple, Hobart were lobbying strongly for it, but the fact that it was going to be Tim Payne's farewell test, that's gone now, and I think Hobart's gone with it, especially after they gave the border spray over the way they treated Payne. That same board would decide the venue of the test, so I think that one's gone. Canberra is a chance, but their capacity of 13,000 doesn't do them any favours. Oh, I wouldn't have thought they would get it, which leaves Sydney and Melbourne. And, look, there's cases for both. Melbourne, the bigger capacity. Sydney, there's a prospect of maybe a day-night test, which they've always wanted. They've always wanted a second test, a day-nighter. So I would say it'd be one of those two tests. The point you made about people being forgiving of the English team is a significant one, Julian, I reckon, because the public are actually, like, the Australian cricketers really get what the Englishmen are saying, because they feel the same. Mm. And they said, even Todd Greenberg from the Australian Cricket Association said, he's made the point. He said, hey, the protocols that these guys agreed to tour under have to, the promises must be met. Now, we all agree that the system must be a little bit elastic, but Perth's had a hard quarantine forever, so that hasn't changed.
I was going to ask you about Tim Payne, but just before we get to that, as you said there, that Cricket Tasmania, well, they've given Cricket Australia a couple of clips in the last couple of weeks. Where will that all end up? Will that simmer down now? Is that going to continue? Will there be talks between the two? Where's that all going to end up?
Yeah, do you know what? I don't really know. I mean, they came out and said the treatment of Payne by Cricket Australia was the worst since Bill Laurie in when he was sacked, and he wasn't even told. He was out working the 1970-71 Ashes. He was replaced by Ian Chappell. There was a difference, of course, Jules, in that Bill Laurie committed no sin. You know, the team just wasn't working for him and struggling. And the great Bill, unfortunately, who we all love, was dismissed as captain and replaced by Ian. And even Ian felt bad about it. But Tim, of course, you know, he had his misdemeanors with his sexting and that. So there was a reason to take some action. So it was a slightly different story. But, yeah, that all happens from time to time. State government bodies take on Cricket Australia and they snipe back at each other, but I wouldn't have thought the damage would be too long lasting.
Speaking to Robert Craddock about all things cricket as we lead up to the start of the Ashes, it's been a tumultuous build up, particularly for the Australians. Just on Friday, I think we got the news here about 5 to 10 in the morning that Tim Payne was stepping away from cricket indefinitely. What was your immediate reaction?
Oh, I think it was sadness, but there was a certain Particularly since the day before we'd had confirmation he was going to play in a one-day game for Tasmania on the Friday. So one of our journalists that spoke to him earlier in the week, Jules, said he was feeling strong, resilient and clear-headed and was looking forward to getting to Brisbane for the test. So then suddenly I think the enormity of it all cascaded in upon him. And it's a very rare sportsman that can put an event of that magnitude hanging on a peg in the dressing room and go out and play. I mean, Tim said when he resigned as captain, I didn't want to become a distraction. Mm. But guess what? Over the next week, it hit him that it would have been a distraction. The Barmy Army had songs made up for him and, you know, it was going to be a torturous 5 or 6 weeks for him. He played no cricket whatsoever. It was going to be so hard for him. So he made, I believe, the decision which was best for him and the team to stand down.
I was going to say, in a way, and obviously the Australian players are supporting Tim and we're all thinking about Tim and his family during this tough time, but the fact that he's taken that selection decision out of their hands, is that a bit of a blessing in disguise?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that George Bailey, who's a business partner of Tim's, wasn't looking forward to making that call. I think they'd have stuck with him. I really do. I think he would have played the test, but that would have created its own issues because, you know, as I said, he would have been such a centrepiece. And I'm always of the belief, Jules, that when a captain resigns from the captaincy, he should leave the team. I mean, 90% of the time, those two moments occur together. Mm. You know, it was the way that most of Australia's captains leave, from Donald Bradman onwards. Some don't. Stephen Smith has returned to play on in different circumstances. Ricky Ponting. But with a guy like sort of even Alan Border, when he left, that was the end. So it's very hard. It's the English way of keeping on for a series or two after you stand down as captain. But there was not a lot that could be achieved by it.
We've got a lot of feedback. Oh, there's been a lot of feedback the last couple of weeks. A lot of anger towards the media over the Tim Payne story. There's been a lot of anger towards Cricket Australia with the way they've handled it and the consequences the new regime made Saturday week ago. But do you think there should be a bit more anger towards Tim Payne? I mean, he was the one that put himself in this situation.
Yeah, I thought everyone was at fault, really, Jules. I mean, Tim obviously, made the mistake of, you know, getting involved with a particular lady, and of course Tim's married. Now, then they rolled the dice, didn't they? Hoping his number would not come up, and he was probably getting away with it. You know, he was going to retire after the last test in Perth, Hobart. So, yeah, look, everyone I felt could have done their job a little bit better on this one. Cricket Australia, they copped, savage criticism for not making it public. One of the reasons they didn't is the lady involved did not want it public. Mm. Now, I know she had 63 charges against her in court, but she wanted privacy on the issue and he was found not guilty. From that point, it's a very difficult decision to say, let's make it public, when the two parties involved say they don't want it made public. So, and there was no guilt found. So it was a tricky one. When we were talking on your station about Sandpapergate a few years ago, you could take a very clear line on the whole narrative. You know, it was the wrong thing to do, blah, blah, blah. And this one, there's breaches of certain codes, but it's a very, very, very tricky situation.
Absolutely. You mentioned Sandpapergate there, and now we know that the new captaincy, the leadership team has been named. Mm. Pat Cummins as captain, Steve Smith as vice captain. I guess a lot of people would have thought that Steve Smith wouldn't be back in a leadership position. A lot of people probably think he shouldn't be back in a leadership position. Where do you sit with all of that? And do you think there will be some blowback to the decision that potentially he can captain Australia again?
Yeah, and I think that's when it'll get really serious. I was doing a cricket club lunch at when the captaincy and vice captaincy were confirmed. So I thought, well, I'll make the most of this. I was up on stage and I said, hands up, this is Friday, anybody who's got a serious objection to Stephen Smith being Australian vice-captain. I reckon there was 180 people in the room and probably 45 put their hands up. That's one in four. And the hands, a lot of them went straight up. You could tell the strength of their feelings. So it just struck me then, Steve Smith's got a lot of work to do. I like the idea of him supporting Cummins, and because Cummins got the guy he wanted to, and if he's going to be a success, Cummins has to get the guy he wants to. And that guy was Smith right from the start, all the way through. If Smith hadn't have been vice captain, I'm still not sure Cummins would have wanted the job, because he needs to have somebody he could rely on. So that's there. But, Julian, you're right. There will be blowback. If you write a story, I wrote one last week saying Smith probably should be vice captain. And within 2 hours, I had about 20 comments. People say, no, mate, no, you've got that wrong. We have to move on. So he's got to win him back. He really does. But it escalates immensely if Cummins pulls a hamstring and misses a test. And if it's in Australia, like say Boxing Day test, S. Smith leads him through the gates. That's when you'll know the full force of it. And it is there, and there are people who will never forgive nor forget. And so while I was pleased to see him get the role, and no one has to apologise for bagging the decision. You know, even I'm torn on it, you know, and I was happy to see him get it. So it's an interesting situation.
And as you said there, Pat Cummins, Steve Smith was the one he wanted. But realistically, was there really a genuine other option? When you look at some of our best other leaders in Australian cricket, they're either on the fringe of the test team or they're not in the test team.
I believe it was talked about for 2 minutes. The possibility, just to cover all bases, Usman Khawaja coming into the team, successful Queensland captain, very experienced, could have done the role that Smith did. But he mightn't even play in the first test. And Manus Labuschagne, who no one is pushing as a leader at all. It disappoints me. I thought I would have liked to seen him a joint vice captain with Smith, because I think you can take Manus on the journey. And Jules, there'll be cricket officials listening to this saying, "Oh, mate, Manus is too much of a boy. He's a little like puppy. He's that sort of guy. He's not a leader." But Jules, we remember when Ricky Ponting was the little mischievous kid that used to have a few extra drinks. When Michael Clarke had the blonde tips and was a bit all over the shop. When Stephen Waugh wouldn't say boo to a goose and was really quiet. You know, when Alan Border never wanted to be Test captain. Now, all of those guys mature. You've got to give a guy a chance to mature and grow, encourage him. So I know Shane Warne was pushing strongly for Manus to be vice-captain, and I really get it. You know, you could have got the guy to grow, you know, because some of these guys start out very young in the head and then they suddenly grow up. Steve Smith. Remember when he couldn't get a date to board a medal and he was the scraggy kid that was no one's idea of a test captain, you know, so they all grow eventually, you know, and so that's the thing about Manus, like the one regret. I wouldn't have mind seeing him being joint vice captain.
Speaking of Robert Craddock, I noticed the comments out of England today from Steve Harmison saying, "I think England would be happier with Cummins than Steve Smith. I look at that decision being a big gamble from Australia." Is there a bit in that from Steve Harmison, or is that about as accurate as his first ball in the 2006 Ashes?
Yeah, I was actually on that podcast. I go on a bit, the Talking Collective podcast, and I actually asked him that question, "What do you think?" And I listened really closely and did that story. It's a totally fair point, because you just think of it. Let's take all the emotion and sentiment out of it about Pat being the glamour boy and all this. Pat Cummins is the bowler, is the single greatest threat to England winning the Ashes. Now, what Harmison is saying is, hey, if you want to burden him with the captaincy, great. I hope it muddles his thinking. His line is simply this. He reckons with the Kookaburra ball, you get about 25 really good overs where it's hard and, you know, a bit of bounce and a bit of swing and that, and then it becomes really hard work. And he said, if your mind's a little bit muddled and you don't get it right in your first spell, you know, you can, and he said, Cummins always does. He's terrific. But what if captaincy takes 15% off Cummins the bowler? He said, well, you don't have to worry about that with Smith. He just does it. So I don't shoot that down at all. It's a genuine, fair point.
Now, we know Pat Cummins is the captain. We know Steve Smith is the vice-captain. But we don't know yet who the wicketkeeper will be to replace Tim Payne. Josh Inglis is actually doing a Zoom presser very shortly, so we'll hear a little bit from him in the next half an hour or so. It seems to be the overall feeling is a race in two between Alex Carey and Josh Inglis. Is that how it is for you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Jimmy Pearson did some lovely work keeping up to the stumps to Michael Nessa and the Queensland fast bowlers against Western Australia at the Gabba a couple of weeks ago. It's terrific keeping. Honestly, keepers are so underrated. You know, no one ever talks about something like that. But he produced a game plan, which I reckon England will copy. To Cameron Green, who bats out of his crease, he said, actually, I'll keep over the stumps to the quicks and bring him back into his crease. And I bet you Josh Butler does it in the Ashes. So that's one to watch. But this is such a difficult decision. I mean, like, I feel Carey slightly in front, but there's a massive push to English, for English. Here's the conundrum, Jules. With Carey, he's just, you know, he's in form. He scored a century yesterday. He's been the man in waiting. He's mature. He's about 30. He's a Gilchrist sort of selection coming in just after the prime or in the prime of his career. And a good solid citizen. Josh Inglis, they feel, is a better keeper to slow bowling. And there's three tours of the Indian subcontinent coming up in the next 18 months. Test tours, big tours. But here's the thing. Inglis has barely played. I think he's played two games of cricket in the last 3 months. Mm. So, it's just hard to get a kid on the back of just a couple of games in a couple of months and say, can you play five tests in 6.5 weeks? Oh, it's the Ashes and it's home. It's the big thing. Like, it's such a Carey-like scenario, such a natural sort of, you know, seems like a natural scenario. So Carey's a slight favourite, but I tell you this, there was a huge push for Inglis in the last week, internally and externally.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see which way they go. Just a couple of other selection, stories around this Australian team. Marcus Harris appeared to be locked in a couple of weeks ago, and if you look at the squad, he's certainly, you think, going to play and open the batting. Are you comfortable with that decision?
Yeah, I was surprised that George Bailey locked him in so early, because I think it's 10 tests and a batting average of 23. But I don't mind. George has spent a lot of his career on the periphery, George Bailey, so he knows the benefits of saying to someone early, you are in. He's going to try and do that. And I like his, he looks you in the eye when he talks to you, George, so he's good like that. I'm standing here outside of my house in Brisbane, looking up at the sky, and I'm seeing grey clouds, which I just know are going to be there in 10 days' time, 9 days' time for the start of the first test. The air feels heavy. Jules, if I took a running leap, I feel I could touch the clouds. And at the function on Friday, I was at the Gabba, and the wicket is as emerald green. It's like it's in Dublin. You know what I mean? So it'll seam and it'll swing. And if Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad have got that outswinger to the left-hander going, I just think they'll have two gullies for Marcus Harris and we'll just say, we are just going to probe you relentlessly, Marcus. You know exactly what we're going to do to you. We're going to go straight, straight, and then away. And if you nibble at one of these, it's going to be a very, very difficult time for you. So he'll be up against it. But they like his improvement. He went to England. He scored centuries. He feels he's tightened up a bit. So, you know, I don't mind the idea of a selector saying we'd like to give him a good run at it. Alan Border said that once about Matthew Hayden when he was averaging 24 and he ended up averaging 50 because Border said, no, he'll be in for a few tests now. And it really put his mind to rest.
And just on that, you mentioned the conditions there. Jai Richardson, what chance he could get into the 11 for that first test?
It's a really good question. And I think if they put him in, he's capable of winning Australia that test. He bowled a spell up here the other day where he took 4 for none and it could have been 6 for none, you know, and he got out Labuschagne, Shane, he got out Burns, and they both went to George Bailey and said, gee, this guy's hot. But here's the thing, Jules, the second test is in Adelaide. The pink ball prince is Mitchell Stark. He's short of bowling. You have to play him in Brisbane. So if you agree that Hazelwood and Cummins are non-negotiables, how does Richardson get in your team? That's my issue. I feel a bit sorry for the bubble boys too. I mean, Mitchell Swepson went around in the World Cup and he's going around with them now. He just can't get his hands on a cricket ball.
Yeah.
You know, it is hard for some of these guys. It really is. And while Mitchell Swepson's just twiddling his thumbs in camp, Matthew Cunnaman, the left-arm spinner, has taken about 20-odd wickets in the Shield for Queensland. So it's interesting.
Our friends from England aren't getting much match practice either.
Oh, no. Look, I went out to the game the other day and it was just miserable. we haven't seen rain like this up in Brisbane for years and years. And I just can't see how it's not a slow seamer at the Gabba on match day. You know, the ball, you know, they'll probe that length. You know, Anderson has to play for mine. I know he's only playing three tests, but surely one of them has to be Brisbane. Yeah.
Nine days to go, Crash. We can't wait. It's been a dramatic build-up, to say the least, and now we wait. The next thing is to see who the keeper will be. Thanks so much for your time this morning, and we look forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you, Jules. It's my absolute pleasure. All the best. Thank you.
Almost home to win the first race ever for the Saudi Williams team. And Frank Williams will be beside himself with joy. Seven wins for Frank Williams' team. Six of them here for Alan Jones.
It's a brutally competitive world, especially if you're running a team. And Frank had a passion for cars, for racing. There was nothing else he was really interested in doing. And he was just remarkable in every respect.
Yeah, the tributes are flowing in for Sir Frank Williams, age 79, who passed away last night. One of the most influential figures ever in the history of Formula One racing. And one man that knows him better than most is the man that drove his first world championship for him, the great Australian Alan Jones, who's been good enough to jump on the line for us this morning. Alan, thanks so much for your time. Wish we could do it in better circumstances.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's nice to be able to verbally give Frank the accolade that he deserves.
What are your emotions when you heard the news of Frank's passing?
Oh, obviously very sad. I mean, apart from being my boss, he was a very good friend, and you know, I used to go to his house on a Sunday and have a game of tennis, and we'd have Sunday lunch, and, you know, he became a very good friend. And the three of us, Patrick Head and Frank Williams and myself, were, you know, we were the three musketeers, the first people to sort of be successful in a Williams car.
And what are your early memories of your sort of early meetings with Frank?
Well, I used to speak to Frank at the odd Grand Prix, but just only on a social basis. And when I was looking for another drive in 1978, Frank approached me and said, you know, would you be interested in having a drive? And I said, yeah, because every driver says yes to every team owner, just in case you've got to pick one. And then he rang me up out of the blue and said, can you meet me on the side of the motorway? I'd like to take you to the factory and have a look at the new car. Which I did, and it was the first car that Frank had actually built. Prior to that, he'd actually purchased other makes, and then, you know, just put his name on them or whatever. But this was a purpose built chassis car that was started from zero to finish, designed by Patrick Head and called a Williams.
What made him such a great racing person?
Oh, he's tireless. He goes beyond passion. I mean, it's just, even the fact that when he became a quadriplegic, I mean, most able-bodied guys, myself included, couldn't go to that many Grand Prix and put up with all that crap for so long. Patrick Head virtually, he retired. But, you know, Frank was in a wheelchair, he'd go to all of them. And some of the circuits were just nightmares to get around, like Monaco and a few of those sort of places. But, you know, Frank, given his disability, he would be at every Grand Prix. He had a passion which was unparalleled.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So that happened in 1986 in a serious car crash, and it wasn't until 2013 that he basically gave up the day-to-day running of his team to his daughter Claire in 2013. So that's a remarkable long stretch that he kept going with such, obviously, a serious ailment that he had. What are your memories of the time when he suffered that serious accident?
Well, the ailments that he had, virtually, I mean, I think he was only given, well, he nearly died about two or three times in a London hospital. But Frank has probably surpassed, I don't know any other word for it, but used by date's probably the wrong choice of words, but, you know, by about 25 or 30 years, given the injury that he had, He wasn't expected to go anywhere near as far as he did, before this happened. But he was just, typical Frank. He was just so determined, so one-eyed, and he just loved motor racing so much. That's all he knew.
Yeah, it's a remarkable record. 9 Constructors' Championships, 7 Driver Championships between 1980 and 1997. I mean, there's a lot of influential figures in a sport, and obviously Sir Frank is right up there. How significant is he in terms of figures for the sport that you've participated in and loved for so many years?
Well, when you look at Ferrari, Lotus, for the amount of Grand Prix that they won, they were in the sport a hell of a long time before Frank, and he's come along and basically equaled just about all of those that record in a very much shorter space of time. I mean, from where he started, I mean, Frank used to wheel and deal out of a public phone box at one stage of the game, wheeling and dealing and used racing car parts. So he's come from very humble beginnings to an icon of motorsport throughout the world.
And on a moment like this, on a day like this, when we reflect on Sir Frank, for you, does it bring memories of 1980 flooding back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was actually talking to Jonathan Williams this morning. He phoned me up and he said, I was with Dad about 2 weeks ago, and he used to love on a Sunday afternoon replaying some of the shots of you in the early car in the early days. He used to love it, and that made me feel really happy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, as it would do. And we've got a lovely tribute here from, we've seen Lewis Hamilton this morning saying, Sir Frank Williams is one of the kindest people I've had the pleasure of meeting in this sport. What he achieved is something truly special. Until his last days, I know he remained a racer and a fighter at heart. His legacy will live on forever. Just the sport overall, Alan, it's the rivalries of what made it over the years. And right now in the sport, we've got a fantastic rivalry and a great race for the championship this year. How have you seen it? There just seems to be a lot of people have fallen in love again with Formula One because of this race for the title. How have you seen it so far this season?
Well, you can't beat a good controversy, can you?
Absolutely.
I mean, the only other thing that would better it if they had a fight on the podium. Bernie Eccleston would love all that. But no, it's been extremely interesting. It's, to watch two guys go down to the line and have that fierce rivalry, I think it's added another dimension to it.
Yeah, well, you were obviously the guest on This Is Your Journey on the weekend, and you spoke about, I guess, how different the drivers are these days compared to your days and the personality that they had and how fiery they were. Is this exactly what the sport needed to get this sort of intensity and almost, for the want of a better word, hatred between two drivers?
Well, yes, exactly. I think, as I said before, you can't beat a bit of controversy. You can't beat a bit of sportsmanship and showmanship. And I mean, to my mind now, and I mean with all due respect, most of the drivers, they're all running around with their makeup boxes and everything and, getting ready to go on the latest CNN feature or whatever it is. But, I just want to see. I mean, they're all too scared to pass in case they touch the stewards and say it's dangerous and, give them about 90 bloody places grid penalty. And it's just all getting ridiculous. I mean, they should just get out there and have a damn good go and have a fight and we see some good wheel-to-wheel racing and, more importantly, overtaking. They've got to do something about the new cars coming out next year, which is going to allow them to travel a little bit closer than what they can now and instigate some more overtaking.
Yeah, that's what we all love to see in the sport. We've got Daniel Ricciardo in there at the moment, but a pretty exciting announcement a couple of weeks ago with young Oscar Piastri that's going to be joining the ranks next year. How good can Oscar be, do you think?
Well, obviously he's very good. I mean, he's won a Formula 3 championship. He's won a Formula 2 championship. He's one of these sort of people that no matter what he puts his bum in, he's successful, and that's always a good sign. I think he's got the ability to go right the way through.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, and you'd see Oscar get a main driver in the years to come. Just on the championship for this year, is Max going to get there, or do you think Lewis Hamilton will get across the line again?
Well, that's the beautiful part about it. It's a bit of a guessing game at the moment, but I'd like to see Max take it off. I actually quite like Max. I like his driving style. A lot of people don't particularly like it. They probably say he's a bit aggressive. But, I just like him because his head's down, bumps up, and he goes for it. So For me, I'd like to see him become world champion.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree. And just before we let you go, Alan, it's been great to have you on the show this morning. You mentioned there you've been in touch with some members of the Williams family. Obviously, a lot of sadness at this time, but sort of overall, what's the sentiment and the feeling amongst the family?
Oh, well, I think, you know, they're very happy that he went peacefully. You know, they more than anybody can appreciate the life that Frank's had, and they can celebrate that. Jonathan just bought an old FW07 Williams about 6 months ago, and he's in the process of restoring all of that. So, I mean, it's in the blood.
Absolutely it is. He certainly packed a lot into his 79 years, and you were a big part of that, particularly in 1980. Alan, thank you so much for jumping on the line and sharing some memories of Sir Frank this morning.
My pleasure.
Great to have Alan Jones, the 1980 Formula One World Champion on the line, paying tribute to the late, great Sir Frank Williams.